You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'd like to welcome everyone here to the Open Society Foundations tonight. My name is Justin Burke. I'm the editor of the news website EurasiaNet, which is an operating program of the Open Society Foundations. And we're here for a talk that will focus on two papers, one on forced sterilization of women in Uzbekistan and the other on the cotton campaign. Watchdog groups, including Human Rights Watch, Freedom House, and Transparency International, have described Uzbekistan as one of the more repressive and corrupt regimes on the planet. And we are here tonight to examine two aspects of state coercion. With us tonight is Natalia Antilava, the author of the Forced Sterilization Report. Natalia is a BBC correspondent. She's currently based in Delhi, but has extensive experience in the Caucasus and Central Asia. We also welcome tonight Matt Fisher Daly, who is the coordinator of the Cotton Campaign, and he'll talk about the campaign's activity and the paper. The Cotton Campaign, for all who may not be aware, is a broad-based coalition bringing together NGO activists, entrepreneurs, investors, and businesses, all in the name of trying to end forced labor, especially forced labor of children in Uzbekistan. So tonight, both Natalia and Matt will speak for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to questions. So I think we'll start with Natalia.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me and for the introduction, and thanks a lot for coming. I think, and I'm sure Matt will sort of talk about similar things, but I think one thing that some of you probably know, it was very important to keep in mind when talking or reading about Uzbekistan, is that no matter what you do that's related to Uzbekistan, whether it's actually in Uzbekistan or outside Uzbekistan, as long as you're speaking to Uzbeks, you always come across this wall of fear, and it's really, really difficult to penetrate it. It's really difficult to get past it and actually find out what really is going on. The forced sterilization is something that I've been interested in for a long time, during my time as a correspondent for the BBC in Central Asia. And at the time, there was some quite good journalism that was coming out of the region. Uzbekistan was still not entirely closed. It was already seriously closing down, but it wasn't entirely closed. There were some good reports that were, you know, dealt with the subject. In 2011, having left the region, I convinced my editors that it was a good idea for me to go to Uzbekistan and try to take a more sort of focused look at this, just at this sterilization, do a documentary about it. So I flew to Tashkent. Unfortunately, the Uzbek government didn't think it was such a good idea for me to come to Uzbekistan, so they asked me, not very politely, to leave. So I got deported, went to Kazakhstan instead. And this is, you know, a bit of a background, but I think a very, very telling part of the story. I, you know, spent a long time in Kazakhstan talking to people, to Uzbeks, and there are plenty of Uzbeks in Kazakhstan, who've come to Almaty. And then myself and the BBC, one of my colleagues from Kazakh side of the BBC, we went to the Kazakh-Uzbek border and basically parked ourselves at the border for a few weeks and hung out. And that turned out to be the best way of getting stories. But it was incredible. We sort of quite early on, we attached ourselves to this group of Uzbeks, and there were about 7 women in it and a few men, and they were waiting for the rest of their families to come across from Uzbekistan, and they were tied up in some sort of red tape, and these guys didn't have enough money to go on to Russia, and there were 2 pregnant women among them. So we thought it would be a good idea to sort of try to find out what their stories are, and we started basically hanging around them, and it was amazing to see that it took 7 days until these women stopped saying, "What sterilization? You know, no, we never heard of such a thing. Everything is fine." And by the end of that week, the woman who was pregnant was saying that she was leaving Uzbekistan because she was pregnant, because she was told by the nurse in the local polyclinic after she had her first baby that she was not to get pregnant again. And every other woman in the group knew someone who had been sterilized, although none of them had the operation. And then one of the women said to me, you know, turn on your camera on the phone. And she recorded this video message to her friend, and then gave me an address of this woman. She called, you know, let's call her Nargis, and said, go and see Nargis, who lives now in Kazakhstan, and she'll tell you what the real story is. And you know, having spent 2 weeks, you know, going back and forth between the border, 2-hour drive there, 2-hour drive back every day, we went and found Nargis, who lived literally next to the hotel where we were staying. And she was the first woman that I met who actually had been sterilized. And her story was, as I subsequently found out, was quite typical. She had a baby. Her pregnancy was normal, but then she was she had a C-section, and during this she had a very long and difficult recovery after the C-section, and failed to get pregnant again. So she was trying to get pregnant, failed to get pregnant, and finally went to a doctor, and the doctor said, "You've had your uterus removed. You can never get pregnant again." She then introduced us to 4 of her friends who had similar stories, although, you know, they varied. None of the others had uteruses removed. All of them had fallopian tubes tied. Some of them were told that it was a reversible procedure. Others didn't even know that it was done on them until much later again. So the typical story is that the woman gets pregnant, gives birth, then tries to get pregnant again, fails to get pregnant, goes to a doctor and finds out that she's had a she had been sterilized. The interviews we did with those women became, you know, the backbone of a radio documentary that I did in 2011, which in turn became the backbone of the research of the paper that you know, was done with the OSI. But I think where the paper is very interesting, and where it really widens out and actually creates a real sort of contribution to the understanding of what's happening, is that for this paper, we have also managed to speak to about, you know, 65 doctors. So out of them, about a dozen were actual 15 doctors were actually interviewed for, you know, how we had a conversation with, and we did a survey of about 53 doctors across Uzbekistan in all 12 regions of Uzbekistan. And what's become clear as a result of it is that, you know, the sterilization campaign by the government is still carrying on. It's happening everywhere across Uzbekistan. So it's not that individual regions are targeted. Rather, you know, across the country, clinics and hospitals are performing the procedures. It hasn't showed any sign of slowing down in the last 5 years. In fact, sadly, since I did the documentary, I think in 2011, and there was quite a big resonance, I think things have become worse, because I think the government has clamped down, has become a lot more secretive about it, has put a lot more pressure on doctors to both carry out the procedure and be a lot more careful when they're talking about it to the outsiders. So So I think it's beyond, I mean, you know, every time sort of you hear the stories, you just wonder why. You know, it's such a bizarre thing to be doing, to be sterilizing, you know, healthy women of your country that are that don't want to be sterilized, that want to carry on having children. And I think that's another thing that the paper does. I think we do manage to, well, there is a lot we still don't know, and there will be always a lot that we won't know, because the government of Uzbekistan says that this is not happening at all. You know, I think we have managed to find enough of government decrees and track down actual specific orders from the Ministry of Health and from, you know, from the president down, that create a very pretty comprehensive picture of why the program is taking place and what's the logic behind it, however, you know, you may argue twisted, and you know, why it's likely to carry on. So I'm conscious that I don't want to carry on for too long, but I'm sure there will be questions as well. So.
As Natalia mentioned, OSF, Open Society Foundations, was instrumental in the publication of this study. I just wanted to make that point. I guess now we'll move over to Matt, who has some video.
Just a couple slides.
Yeah, a couple of slides.
But I just wanted to pick up on a couple of themes that Natalia mentioned, this concept of fear and how pervasive it is in Uzbekistan, and what that means in terms of people, in a practical sense, not being able to exercise their rights. And then the other point about a very centralized chain of command for carrying out nationwide policies. And those are two features that we see in the cotton sector in Uzbekistan. And as you know, thank you, Justin and OSF, for hosting this tonight. You know, I'm going to share a bit about the cotton sector in Uzbekistan. Essentially, the system, it's a forced labor system of cotton production. A bit about this year's cotton harvest, which is the report that was recently put out and is both on our website, and I think Justin has a copy here today. The harvest just finished a couple weeks ago, so that's a very new report. But reports have been consistent since at least 2005. And as Justin mentioned, I coordinate a coalition called the Cotton Campaign, which is a set of, yes, NGOs and trade unions and business associations and investors and activists around the world that work to end forced labor in Uzbekistan, precisely because it is, in a practical sense, impossible for Uzbek citizens to exercise their rights vis-a-vis their government. So I'll share some key facts, and then, you know, we can move on to a discussion. But essentially, the cotton industry in Uzbekistan, Uzbekistan is the fifth largest exporter of cotton in the world. It has been a country with a significant amount of cotton production since Soviet times. Under the Soviet Union, they established essentially a monoculture. Currently, about 75% of Uzbekistan's cotton is exported, and 25% is manufactured within Uzbekistan into yarns and fabrics and such. A lot of those exports go primarily to China and Bangladesh, also some other countries like Russia, but increasingly to China and Bangladesh. That which is processed inside Uzbekistan, some of the main companies there are the Korean conglomerate Daewoo International and the Singaporean company Indorama Corporation. And as Justin introduced this piece, when we're talking about cotton or forced sterilization, those are both the forced labor in the cotton sector and the forced sterilization nationwide are in the context of what is really a horrendous human rights situation in Uzbekistan. The lack of freedoms extend beyond forced labor and labor conditions into things like freedom of the press and freedom of association generally. And one of the key features to keep in mind is, so where does all the income from cotton go? You know, there's an approximate estimation of about $1 billion annually of income from sales of cotton. And that does not show up in national accounts. It goes into what is called an agricultural fund, and only the highest in the government elite really have access and knowledge about that account. And that's true not only of cotton, but of some other key exports like gold in Uzbekistan. But fundamentally, it is a state order system, and it's underpinned by forced labor. So that, you know, that is that the government itself is orchestrating a forced labor system of production. This means that it starts with the farmers. You see here pictured a farmer who I met in 2012 during the cotton harvest. And the way agriculture is set up, the government owns the land and leases land to farmers. And those agreements oblige the farmers to produce a certain amount of cotton every year and to dedicate a percentage of their land to cotton production. And if you do not meet your cotton quota on an annual basis, the government can give that land to another farmer. So you lose your livelihood if you're a farmer and you fail to meet your quota. So how do you get the cotton from the farmers? Yes, the state purchases the cotton. The state procurement price for cotton is well below not only world cotton prices or U.S. cotton prices, but it's below the cost of production. So this means for farmers, many of them are either going into debt or are risking their freedom by producing more non-cotton crops and selling those crops in order to, you know, provide for their families, or they're emigrating, which means that the agricultural society in Uzbekistan is losing a lot of its expertise. And in some of the very worst cases, particularly the last few years, we've seen a number of suicides by Uzbek farmers who are just desperate. What you see pictured on the other side of this slide here, that is a letter from one of the regional prosecutor's offices, and it's confirming the opening of a criminal case against farmers who planted vegetables instead of cotton, and it requests security support from the district head of police. So if farmers are paid below cost, you know, who's harvesting the cotton? Annually, the government coercively mobilizes over 1 million children and adults to go pick cotton in the fields. So in terms of the children, historically, that meant all schools nationwide were shut down and the children went out to pick cotton. In the last couple years, there has been a slight shift so that young school children under age 15 have not been mobilized nationwide. However, most 15 to 17-year-old children, and some as young as 11, continue to be sent out to the cotton fields across the country. And we saw this in 2013. Essentially, the young students, the children, are given the option to go pick cotton, pay for an exemption, or face a threat of expulsion from school. And those exemptions range from, you know, $250 to $400, which may not sound like a lot, but keeping in mind that per capita annual income is around $1,700, or a teacher in Uzbekistan makes somewhere around $250 a month. So it's a rather large sum. And in terms of these threats, they are very real. What you see pictured next to this young woman in the photo is a statement that students and parents were obliged to sign before this year and the 2012 cotton harvest. In 2012, but even more so in 2013, one of the biggest changes we saw was that the government took extensive measures to hide the forced aspect of the mobilization and present an image of voluntary participation in the cotton sector. So that statement reads, translated, that I, Matt, a student of course number 101, agree to obey all the internal rules and regulations at the college and attend all the classes. I also agree to participate in cotton harvesting, the national wealth of our nation, and sincerely fulfill my duty to my country, my nation, my family. Goes on another couple sentences and says, if I do not fulfill my above-mentioned promise, I agree to be left to retake the course and be penalized by all means showed in the law. So we've seen in the last few years that these threats are very real. In fact, this year in September, a young student named Barhoyot Turayev, 16 years old, refused to pick cotton, and he was expelled from his school. In 2012, there were university officials that went on record stating that, indeed, it is policy that students are expelled if they don't pick cotton. So, as mentioned before, authorities send adults as well as children. And this includes not just the farmers, but it also includes public sector workers. And in Uzbekistan, that means teachers, doctors, nurses, military personnel, etc. It also includes the private sector. A couple of companies involved this year, that is, that were pressured to send either employees to work and or financial contributions, included Shirtanafgas, which is a gas company, Trust Bank, a bank, and GM Uzbekistan, which is a joint venture between the Uzbek government and General Motors. And similar to the students, the government uses significant coercion to get the adults to go out and pick cotton. What does that mean? It means if you're a public sector worker, your job is conditioned on your participation in the cotton harvest. In fact, they introduce into public sector contracts a clause that you will participate, and you have to sign that in order to maintain your job. You can also lose your salary, for example. It's another means of punishment. So how is the harvest managed? Getting back to this idea of a centralized chain of command, in the springtime every year, at the national level, a national production target is set, and that is then divided up by regions, and regional governors have a responsibility for meeting their regional production target. So then they work with the district level heads of government agencies and with those who oversee businesses to then establish quotas at the individual level. So this year, the individual quota for picking cotton in a day was around 50 kilograms. It varies from a little bit more than that during the beginning of the harvest to a little bit less than that at the end of the harvest. However, a lot of people, particularly when you have children and young folks out there doing the work, have difficulties meeting that quota. So they end up having to pay local folks to help them out or otherwise contribute their own income. And they end up paying money in addition to giving their labor to the government system of production. So real quickly, because I want to get on to discussion, it's important to keep in mind cotton picking is not something any of us would want to do. It's hazardous. In addition to facing the natural elements, you're bent over for the vast majority of the day. People work on average about 10 hours a day. The way the system is set up in Uzbekistan, a lot of people are sent far away from their homes, so they stay in accommodations that the government provides, which are often unsanitary and don't have adequate conditions. There's also the significant health risk of agrochemicals, which, getting back to this transparency issue, it's very difficult to understand what level of chemicals is used, but we have seen trucks spraying chemicals on fields while children and adults are working. Very sadly, this year was one of the most tragic cotton harvests on record. At least 11 people died as a result of this forced labor system of production. These are their names here. Our report goes into further detail in each of their cases. But it really, you know, it indicates how people are considered in terms of an input for this cotton production system. So what to do about it? That's where the cotton campaign came about. And this year, for the first time, the International Labor Organization, which is the United Nations agency with a mandate to oversee labor conditions around the world, for the first time they had monitors in Uzbekistan. For several years now, workers and employers at the international level had been calling for a very specific, independent, and unfettered access monitoring mission. Unfortunately, this year, there's a very circumscribed scope for the monitors, and the government did accompany the monitors everywhere they went, which gets back to this question of fear. It's very difficult to gather information from Uzbek citizens if the government is present. So the big question remains if this is the start of a process of reform or not. And truly, that, you know, the answer to that question lies in Tashkent. We won't know until the government starts to signal what their plans are. That ILO mission's report will come out the first quarter of 2014, so in the next few months. But so far, the signals are not very good. The Uzbek government has continued to deny the problem. And in fact, throughout the harvest, they continued to harass Uzbek citizens that were documenting and reporting out on what was happening. Three individuals in particular, one was arrested, detained, held incommunicado for 12 days. Another was sentenced to 4 years in prison during the harvest. And a third was placed under house arrest, so he couldn't monitor and report the way he had in years past. So what will it take? These are the cases that I mentioned. When you look at, 2013, there were international monitors and things looked very much the way they did in years past. This really raises the question of incentives. To truly end forced labor of children and adults in Uzbekistan, it will require reducing the incentives for the government to continue the practice, right? So what you see here is a demonstrative map of the flow of Uzbek cotton. The blue are the Uzbek government-controlled firms. The green are Uzbekistan-based firms that partner with the Uzbek government to buy cotton and process it in-country, and then, you know, export yarn or fabrics, things of that nature. And the yellow are companies that are supporting by doing business with Uzbek cotton, so cotton traders and apparel companies, etc. And so that brings in some of the work that the cotton campaign does. When you look at the apparel industry, and that's the industry that uses the most cotton in the world. So Uzbekistan, fifth largest exporter of cotton, that goes to China, goes to Bangladesh, makes its way into apparel supply chains. Currently, most apparel companies do not have supply chains that are transparent enough to know where the cotton came from. Right? That's just the way they're structured. There are probably 5 to 6 companies between the brand or retail company that we recognize and the spinning factory, which is the last point in that supply chain that knows the country of origin of cotton. So we as a campaign, as a coalition, we have been calling on companies based in Uzbekistan to meet their, you know, basic human rights due diligence by monitoring and ensuring that they don't buy cotton from forced labor. That is, don't buy cotton until the system is ended. And in terms of the brands and retailers worldwide, it's, you know, a no forced labor cotton, that is no Uzbek cotton, until the system is reformed. And I can get into further details on that in discussion. There is also a significant role for governments. Number one, a lot of governments have bilateral relationships with Uzbekistan. Certainly the United States does. Certainly the European Union does. Other big countries, Russia, China, Bangladesh for trade. We as a coalition do a lot of engagement and advocacy both in Washington and in Brussels. And essentially we're asking to use your bilateral relationship to keep ending forced labor on the agenda when you meet with the Uzbek government, but also to enforce laws that prohibit trade with goods that are made in with forced labor or child labor. And a couple, you see a couple examples of those type of trade regulations, the Tariff Act, the Generalized System of Preferences for Trade. There's also the role for countries like the United States, European Union member states, and other members of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, to ensure that their companies are meeting human rights due diligence when they're working in Uzbekistan or any other country for that matter. But that means essentially knowing what risks to human rights violations there are, monitoring for any violations of human rights in your own operations and in your supply chain, and remediating when there are violations that are identified. So thank you, and with that, I think it's probably good for discussion.
All right, Natalia, Matt, thank you very much. Before I turn it over to the floor for questions, I'm going to assert the moderator's prerogative of asking a question. Natalia, when it comes to forced sterilization, what is the government's motivation? What's in it for the government to force doctors to perform these procedures? Is Uzbekistan facing a demographic situation like China where they need to reduce the population in, say, the Fergana Valley? Can Uzbekistan feed itself? What are the factors that go into this?
Well, the economy and the population are definitely some key factors. You know, they're the reasons. They're the reasons why this is being done. And, you know, the health officials that I have spoken, to be honest, I had spoken to one source at the health ministry and some senior doctors. They say, look, we have tried. We've tried all other ways. We've tried all other ways of birth control, and it doesn't work. The women won't take it. The families won't accept it. This is the only way of doing it. The problem is that, like with everything else in Uzbekistan, you can't really know what the real numbers are. So we don't even know what the real, you know, what the population of Uzbekistan is. They haven't had a census for years and years. They, you know, the figures are massaged, you know, so much that by the time you get them, they're completely untrustworthy. So, but the conventional, the accepted sort of fact is, you know, Uzbekistan is the most populous country in Central Asia. Its population is growing very fast. It can create, you know, Islam Karimov, the president, wants to control the population, and this is, he has tried to control the population through other means, and, you know, this is the only way that they can do it successfully. But I think one important thing to keep in mind is that, you know, it's very clear that there are certain quotas on the number of sterilizations that doctors perform, but it's very difficult to trace these quotas up the whole way up to Tashkent. So while the country is extremely centralized, it also, there's also a real sense of competition between, you know, lower down the chain of command, between the local bureaucrats, local hospitals, local doctors, to outperform each other. So, you know, we don't know whether the quota was set at, you know, Fergana Valley has to turn in, you know, 7,000 sterilizations a month. There is no piece of paper that says that. Those orders, from what we understand, are passed on orally, but then, you know, the people who get these orders try very hard to please, you know, their bosses, and I want to be the running a hospital that does, you know, more sterilizations than the hospital next door. And the interesting thing is that a lot of doctors that I've spoken to actually believe that this is the right thing to be doing, because they say, look, otherwise these women won't stop having children, and it's bad for their health, and it's bad for their it's bad for the economy, it's bad for the for the society as a whole, and so on. So there are quite a few who disagree with it and have a real problem with it, but there are also many who do not have a problem doing it.
Thank you. So I will work this way over here. Yes.
Hi. I have a question.
If you could identify yourself, please.
Oh, okay. My name is Tara Valutis. I'm an American documentary filmmaker, but I live in Bangkok. I know that Uzbekistan, it has some of the highest, sort of a two-part question. I know that Uzbekistan has some of the highest incidents of domestic violence in the world. And I was wondering how the husbands, if they're involved in the sterilization, are they giving permission to the doctors?
You know, I'd be really interested to find out where the numbers of the highest domestic violence come from, because again, as with all statistics, there is, you know, considering how close the society is, I would be very skeptical about, you know, the figures, whatever the figures
are. Do you disagree with that?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, because it's not something that people will openly talk to. And I imagine what the only thing I know is that it would be impossible the way things are in Uzbekistan. It would be completely impossible right now to measure domestic violence.
It's actually in Lonely Planet. I know that's what.
Right. I'm not sure. Lonely Planet.
I was in Uzbekistan in 2012, and I was interviewing a lot of young women, and you know, it took me a while for them to speak to me, but most of the women that I spoke to were either being abused by their fathers or their husbands.
I have no doubt that there are high levels of domestic violence in Uzbekistan, but okay, I would be very cautious about saying highest. You know, I don't think there's any way of sort of saying it's higher than, say, in India. But it's a very good question. I think right now, in order to perform a sterilization, they need a consent of either the patient or the or a partner, and they will often. But the people are very, very negative about it. I mean, an Uzbek men will never, I'm sure there are exceptions to every rule, but family is a huge deal in Central Asia in general, in Uzbekistan in particular. Children, are the number of children you have are basically a measure of your success for both men and women. And to lose an ability to bear a child is a huge deal for the entire family, for both men and women. So the men that I have spoken with are just as angry as women about what has happened, but there have also been cases of men leaving the wives who had been sterilized, because in many cases, you know, it's not just it's quite a simple procedure, and sort of it's laparoscopic procedure where your tubes are tied, but it's often not being performed properly. A lot of these women there have subsequent problems and health problems, and there are lots of examples, and in the report there are a few quite heartbreaking examples of basically completely ruined lives because of the procedure for both men and women.
Okay, real quick, second part of the question is, I see a lot, I work with human trafficking in Southeast Asia, and there's a lot of Uzbek women that are working in prostitution in Bangkok. Some of them are there voluntarily, but some of them have been trafficked there. So just out of curiosity, do you ever get involved at all in the human trafficking and the sex?
I've done a lot of human trafficking stuff, but never in Central Asia.
Okay.
So.
It's really a big
it's huge. There are a lot of Uzbek women in Thailand, in a lot of, you know, and there are a lot of there is a lot of prostitution in Uzbekistan as well. Uzbekistan, someone was telling me recently that I live in Delhi, and recently Uzbekistan has became the number one destination for sort of mid-level businessmen for weekend trips, for belly dancing clubs and so on, and a lot of girls.
Okay, we'll go over here, please.
Regarding the forced labor, could you tell us how long the harvesting is? What's the obligation of forced labor? It's how many weeks, months? Second thing is Uzbekistan is a pretty large country. And what areas of Uzbekistan grow cotton? Is it the Fergana Valley, or is it some areas are desert areas, so they obviously can't grow cotton. So can you just outline the areas where cotton is grown?
Sure, both good questions. So on the length, the harvest typically starts the end of August or beginning of September and runs to the end of October or beginning of November. So this year, for example, it was more or less from the 6th of October until about the 15th of November. In terms of the people who are sent to pick cotton, it varies a bit. Most of the teenagers, so 15, 16, 17-year-olds and university students, are sent for anywhere from a month to 2 months, so essentially the whole harvest. The adults, in particularly the public sector workers, are usually sent in shifts. So, for example, some doctors that we've interviewed, they described how their hospital would have teams of, half the staff would go for 10 days, return, and the other group of staff would go for the next 10 days. So they'd go in shifts like that. So it varies a bit on the timing. The issue of where Uzbekistan grows cotton is an interesting question on multiple levels, because part of this desertification that you mentioned, it was not always a desert. So it's historically steppe lands, and one of the biggest tragedies is, in fact, the monoculture of cotton contributed significantly to desiccation of the Aral Sea. In the last 50 years, the Aral Sea is now 20% of what it was 50 years ago. And so a large aspect, particularly of the northwestern section of Uzbekistan, now very much looks like desert. But it's not only desert, it's in fact contaminated soil, what little water is there. A lot of the fishing has been wiped out. Both soil, water, and air have significantly high levels of residues from the large amount of chemicals that was used for several decades. Now, it's getting back to this transparency issue, it's very difficult to know what chemicals are used any longer in the production of cotton. But there continues to be cotton production in basically every region of Uzbekistan. It just varies how much. So yes, the Fergana Valley is the most fertile, and so there's a lot of production there. But also Jizak region is a significant producer of cotton. And we don't have documentation of the quotas for each region to give you that level of detail. But it, every region there's some. Fergana, Jizak, Namangan are a couple where there's a lot of cotton production.
Maybe this is just a tall order, or maybe the only way that you would ever get a practice such as these to end is if they just westernized their economies, and just if the government simply allowed a farmland to be privatized, and then that whole element of coercion just might end. But maybe that's the reason that's such a tall order, is because in Asia you tend to have authoritarian governments. I mean, even in those nations where, in industries are privatized, you still have authoritarian governments. I mean, just look at Russia. I'm not sure just how Uzbekistan how it's changed since the fall of the Iron Curtain.
actually one difference between, there's a bit of an overlap with birth control and the cotton, because one of the stories that I heard quite a lot was before they started sterilizing, there was a massive campaign of forcing IUDs, which is intrauterine devices, the coils on women. And they would, during the cotton harvest, they would set up little field hospitals and get all the women in and put IUDs in. And, you know, and the women, I've talked to women who would say, I was kicking and screaming, and they still did it. But one difference between sterilization and the cotton harvest, you know, cotton, the forced labor has been part of the Uzbek economy for as long as the cotton has existed. You know, all everyone who grew up in the Soviet Union or Uzbeks would, you know, the part of their childhood memories is going often to the cotton harvest. This is a much more, and it carried on, and some would argue became a lot more brutal since the collapse of the Soviet Union. This is to address your question about how Uzbekistan has changed. The sterilization is something that's very new. It didn't exist in the Soviet Union. So if it's changing, it's definitely not changing for the better. So that would be a solution, that one that you suggest, but it's very unlikely.
If I may, just one thing to add to that is, you know, thinking long term of whatever direction the political and economic system goes, even if it were a privatized farm system, agricultural system, you know, unfortunately, forced labor and child labor exists in agriculture worldwide, in the U.S. and other places. So one of the aspects that we try to work on is, well, who has the influence going forward, even if the government pulls back somewhat from its centralized control of the cotton sector and agriculture generally? There's still companies that are buying those products and have responsibilities to make sure that their supply chains are meeting what they say to the world are their standards, right? So there's the dual role of the government has a significant responsibility to protect the rights of their citizens, but there's also a private sector responsibility to ensure that they're not, number one, contributing to any violations, but number two, avoiding their supply chains being part of that.
Maya Jalashvili, UNDP. My question is to Natalia. It's also regarding one of the reasons why government has resorted to these gruesome measures of forced sterilization. And one of the reasons mentioned in media and also in some of the reports was kind of reason of reducing maternal mortality. And I mean, if this is the reason, this is one of the questions, whether it is one of the reasons from the government side to do that, and then if it is one of the reason, then also considering that government is getting compliments regarding reducing maternal mortality now in the context of Millennium Development Goals, and we're getting close to the 2015, so government has to show some results. Whether, if it is happening and if it's the reason, and government is getting benefits publicly, you know, from outside, from international community, because of these positive results, whether international community is kind of looking at the process, how government is achieving that, and what they're raising these questions.
I think it's a really, thanks for bringing it up, because it's a really, really important aspect of it. And yes, you're absolutely right. And the report, the paper that I've written, you know, deals with it at length. I think what happened in Uzbekistan is that, you know, from 2005, Islam Karimov became pariah in the West, and the government was, you know, from the sanctions, the withdrawal of the Americans, and the withdrawal of the aid, which started happening much earlier, and also, you know, all sorts of, he was slagged off on all fronts constantly all the time. The only area where the Uzbek government received praise was maternal mortality and health of women. And they clung onto it like there was no tomorrow. You know, it became like the panacea of their troubles. It became the one thing that, you know, they felt they got right. And And I'm completely convinced that you're right, that this became one of the big motivations of sort of achieving these numbers and lowering the maternal mortality. Because if you read Karimov's speeches over the last 5-6 years, it is striking how often he refers to the international community's praise for Uzbekistan as a country that has managed to lower maternal mortality. And this is where also the international community, all the UN agencies that are operating in Uzbekistan have a massive responsibility, which they're not meeting at all. Because, I have completely failed to talk to UNICEF. UNICEF is running big programs in Uzbekistan that deal with maternal health. They would not respond to any of my, very persistent attempts to speak to them. Other UN agencies did, UNDP did neither, but either the UN Population Fund, I've spoken to them, and that was the only agency that the representative that I talked to said that he was really concerned about it, about the issue. All the others pretend that it doesn't exist. And I think it's a real shame, considering, despite the fact that the cotton forced labor is still carrying on, the pressure that was put on the Uzbek government by UNICEF and mainly by the ones that are operating in Uzbekistan has made some sort of difference, at least made a difference in terms of shaming them. Whereas with this issue, lowering maternal mortality, Uzbekistan's success at lowering maternal mortality sort of remains unquestioned. And I think that's pretty outrageous, and this is when the international agencies on the ground have to step in.
As a follow-up to the privatization question, I noticed in your slides the usual international corporate transgressors, Archer Daniels Midland and Monsanto. And do you have any suggestions on how, we here in the West can make some accountability for their behavior?
So some of the big agricultural firms, like the two, Monsanto and ADM, and are sort of in this area in the category of seeds and providing seeds. The biggest actors in Uzbekistan, though, are probably the cotton traders, in terms of multinational companies of that size, of the Monsanto size and such. The biggest challenge there is a complete lack of transparency in commodity trading. And they're difficult to get after and suggest that they be more transparent because they're mostly privately owned companies. So I'm talking about like Cargill. It's Cargill UK, for example, that has offices in Tashkent and continues to use Uzbek cotton. One cotton trader based in France named Devcot did in fact stop using Uzbek cotton and stated that they will not use it again until there's significant reforms on the ground. And that was after the OECD in France recommended that they do that and state very clearly that if you're trading Uzbek cotton, you're violating OECD guidelines for multinational companies. So it's, in terms of consumers, it's hard to get after the cotton trading companies, but where consumers can have a difference in the long term is by asking the question when you purchase clothing, essentially. If that company knows, if Gap, if American Apparel, wherever it is, knows where their cotton comes from. That simple question would start to push in the right direction to get the cotton traders. Because unfortunately, the cotton traders are a difficult nut to crack in this
one. I'll go way in the back.
Yeah, hi. My name's Sarah. I'm a public health worker and a nurse, and I lived in Turkmenistan for several years. So my question is sort of within the reference of Turkmenistan, but I think there's a lot of parallels between the two. For Natalia, is there do you see that there's ethnic targeting for the forced sterilization? Like in Turkmenistan, there was a national effort to sort of rid the country of Russians in particular and other ethnic groups who weren't ethnically Turkmen. Do you see that with forced sterilization?
I think the mood is slightly different in Uzbekistan, but some groups are definitely a lot more vulnerable than the others. And for example, if you're a Roma woman in Uzbekistan, you know, you give birth, you have no chance of not being sterilized, you know, but most Roma women get sterilized. And I think socioeconomic, it's hard for me, it's very clear with Romas, otherwise it's very hard to sort of make that link with particular other groups. So I think socioeconomic plays a clearer role than ethnic. Once you move up from Roma, who are considered the bottom of the society. But interestingly enough, it's probably the opposite with Russians, because Russians in Uzbekistan still tend to live in urban, more developed areas, tend to be better off economically, so tend to go to better hospitals or be able to pay nurses and doctors. So are more educated, because a lot of this comes from lack of education as well and lack of questioning of doctors and this hangover of the Soviet medical system, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And there's been a very dramatic rise in C-sections since the sterilizations were introduced. And I know women who have refused to have C-sections and who have then subsequently saved themselves from being sterilized, but women who don't, and those tend to be poorer women. But mostly more likely to be Uzbek, actually, than Russian.
I'm Peter Sinnott. I know of some women who have gone through this in Uzbekistan, and they were from the educated class in Tashkent. And this was all done in Sampi clinic, natal clinic in Tashkent. And I'm wondering if we're missing a factor, and that factor might be the huge level of male out-migration in Uzbekistan, which is now for quite a while. For instance, I also know a woman who was a nurse and was trained in teaching basic birth control approaches, and she was assigned to do this in an area of Uzbekistan that's somewhat rural. And this, what she happened to her was she was attacked by the husbands. Now, given the greater levels of male out-migration for labor, you know, I'm wondering if this might be a factor in the lack of response by some of the husbands. And the other point is for Mr. Fisher Daly. In the mid-70s, an American academic published an article which looked at the production of cotton harvesting machinery from 1960 or 61 to the early 70s. And of course, the problem was, what impact did that have? As ironic as it would be, I was learning Uzbek and I ended up in a village called Janabi Zarkent in 1986, and lo and behold, I stayed in the dormitory for just such a place to train you to repair these machines. Huge diesel engines and classrooms and the like. But still, we have to come to this point. Where is the mechanization? If you looked at a book that would explain in Uzbek the whole process of the wonderful cotton production, you would think back to something in the 1920s in the United States, and that would be in the 1980s. So why are we missing this point? And the aspect of forced labor, I think there's another point to this. I think there is because I know from experience of Uzbeks who have been basically arrested for whatever reason on trumped up charges in rural areas, sent to lengthy prison terms, and then lo and behold, after 4 years in some hellhole, they are given the option of basically living on a very substandard wage, and what do you know, they're involved in a cotton harvest for quite a period of time. So I'm really wondering about the economic paradox. And as for the problem of
the domestic violence. This was came out in a USAID funded a report. It's in Uzbek language. Came out late 90s. I don't know if Soros, it might have had a backing of it. I don't know, but it doesn't look at things directly. It's always a little bit indirectly. But of course, Gulnara Karimova, if you investigate her role in how visas for women are obtained, some years back, you might find that there was a bit of a monopoly for some places.
You may well be right. The lack of men has had a huge effect on everything in Uzbekistan, so I'm sure it plays a certain role as well. I don't know how, given how focused the pressure is on families and on women, I don't know how much difference it would have made. Some difference. I don't know if it makes it, if it would make a fundamental difference. I can't really imagine sort of all Uzbek men standing up for the rights of their women, because they're just not standing up for the rights of anybody at the moment. You know, people are coerced into these procedures, and they're forced, and they're threatened. And I've spoken to women who have been told that they would lose jobs in state schools or nurseries, you know, teachers who would, or the doctor. I've actually spoken to a female doctor who decided to be sterilized because she was threatened that she'd lose her job if she wasn't. And I think there's some women who sort of make this choice and never tell the husbands. And there are certainly women who make the choice because they don't want to have any more children too, and because their husbands, you know, want to keep having children. There are those cases as well. I mean, what role the coercion plays in it in general, I think Uzbekistan would have been a different country if millions of Uzbeks were not living and working abroad. So I think everything would have been slightly different. So yes, you're right, but at the same time, I think we don't know how different it would be.
Yeah, great points on the mechanization, and you know, I think it's a standing question whether they can move towards mechanization. And in fact, during this harvest, the Prime Minister made statements to the press saying that in the next few years we're going to go to 90% of the cotton being cultivated with machines. Well, you don't really see cotton picking harvest combines in Uzbekistan. I mean, you see people picking fields. It is very much like a century ago in the U.S. or so. You know, I think they're a long way off, and that is very much an economic question. It is, you know, as mentioned, we talk about this with U.S. government and European Union governments and such, and in one of those conversations, a longtime Central Asia person mentioned, you know, you have to think about cotton like it's the blood of the Uzbek political system. So the more, it's the one economic sector that they have full control over. You know, there are other export sectors in which folks who are elites in Uzbekistan have significant shares or control, I mean, gold and such. But even in those sectors, there's oftentimes significant influence of companies, non-Uzbek companies, foreign direct investment and such. But in cotton, it is fully controlled by the government. And, you know, it gets back to this control issue. If you mechanize, that starts to bring into the picture, how do you control the farmers? And, it may be a possibility in the future, and it will also bring into question the potential environmental limits of production as well. So it's a big question. One quick other point on that is what it looks like in the countryside. There have been some good additional studies. It sounds like some of the work that you've been involved in the past. Just last year, there was a scholar named Arnold Zack, who is a U.S. scholar, but he spent a good chunk of the 90s and 2000s living in rural Uzbekistan, and put out a book last year that it is useful for folks to check out. It's not really long, but it gives a sense of what it's like to try and make a living as a farmer in Uzbekistan. It's not easy.
I was just going to add, I think with both the cotton harvest and sterilization, like with so many other things, and this goes back to the question of why isn't, you know, why aren't there, where are the machines? I think, you know, it's also important to remember that a big part of the Uzbek state psyche now is that, you know, humiliation is a very useful control tool. And, you know, you don't want to make people's lives easier. You don't want to create good life for people because this is how the Uzbek government controls them. So,
yeah, I completely agree.
I have a question for actually both of you. One thing is the uptake of contraception is actually a really interesting question because I certainly am not aware of any sort of sex education programs that they have at the national level at all in Uzbekistan. Certainly among youth, not among younger women, newly married women. What I'm finding is that a lot of women are coming in with not really understanding the reproductive health at all. One thing, though, that's interesting is that older women are interested in contraceptives such as IUDs and sterilization, in fact. Voluntary sterilization in Uzbekistan. But one thing that I was kind of wondering is sterilization is actually not such a simple procedure. It does require an incision. It requires general anesthesia. So who's training these providers? And then the second question is also, and I think your report kind of talks a little bit about this, is what is the provider attitude about sterilization?
What is the provider
attitudes?
Attitudes towards the sterilization. Yeah. I don't know what the training is. The doctors that I've spoken to say that, you know, it's part of the general training. So the surgeons and the I don't know if the midwives, I don't think midwives do it, but the surgeons do it. So it's something, you know, nurses definitely don't sterilize in rural clinics. I think for sterilization, women tend to be taken to bigger hospitals. In terms of attitudes, as I said, quite a few people that I've spoken to are at least not negative about it. They say, not ideal, but you know, there is nothing else works. They won't use condoms, they won't be on the pill, they want, and that goes back to the question of sex education, because the government also says that, well, we've tried with sex education, and you know, there is a real kind of backlash, resistance to it because of the traditional values and so on, which is very, you know, very hypocritical thing to say, considering that, you know, people who have tried, there was a very famous Uzbek rights activist, Maxim Popov, I think, who was imprisoned for trying to publish a book about AIDS education. And he was accused of, you know, going against the traditional Uzbek values and so on. So it's almost like a different sphere. And I know USAID had some sex education programs, but they have been they no longer do. So so many doctors say, and this also has to do with sort of the attitude, the general attitude and relationship between a doctor and the physician and a patient. In all of the former Soviet Union, and especially in Uzbekistan, where any figure of authority, like in every dictatorship, you have lots of little dictators, right? Anyone who's more important than you is a little dictator. So that's how patients tend to look at doctors. I mean, they do what doctors say, they don't argue, and doctors, you know, more often than not, from what I've experienced, treat patients pretty badly. And there is very little respect, there is very little consideration, and they, you know, they tell them what to do and they expect them to do it. And if they, you know, do a C-section and then they don't tell them that they will also tie the tubes, so be it, because they believe that they're doing it for some sort of a greater cause. Now, having said that, there are doctors who disagree with it, and you know, if I would have never been able to do this survey of, you know, 60 doctors, if there weren't doctors in the country who were helping me to do it, and these are people who have been trying to do something about it. And again, going back to the international organizations issue, those doctors that I've been talking to say that they have tried again and again and again to go to the embassies in Tashkent, to go to the UNDP, UNICEF, the UN Population Fund. They've contacted the American embassy, the Germans, the Brits, and nobody is interested. No one responds. So.
I was just wondering. Correct me if I'm not right, but so is the focus of the campaign on child labor or forced labor? And then if let's say the Uzbek government do end child labor, does that mean there's going to be repercussions for other groups such as these government workers, company workers who are forced to go in the field?
Yeah. So. The campaign's focused on forced labor because the child labor is a symptom of the forced labor system. So until you can have farmers hiring people, you will continue to have child labor. And so they're intertwined, and we've seen that very dramatically the last couple years as the government has taken some steps to essentially increase the average age of those forced to pick cotton. So the school children of, you know, ages 10 through 14 have not been mobilized as massively as they had in years past. That does put a bigger burden on those who are over the age of 15. And a big question there is how sustainable that is. And, you know, the Uzbek government continues to deny that there's either forced or child labor, but they've actively taken some steps about the child labor issue. The big question is that a way to try and protect themselves from the reforms of the actual production system? Or is that a baby step towards reforms of the system? And we're trying to push it in the latter direction of being reforms of the system, which would get at adult and child forced labor. Does that make sense?
Okay, I think we have time for one or two more questions.
Kim Vu, an environmental law attorney. My question is directed at Matt. Obviously, the cotton industry is very important politically and economically for the country, but from what you described about the degradation of the river system there and how much it had decreased in such a short period of time, it just seems like such an unsustainable agricultural practice in the country. And my question is whether there is any organizations or discourse about alternative to the cotton industry, alternative agricultural practices or other industry practices that might substitute for cotton.
There not on a significant scale, at least that I'm aware of. I personally think that there ought to be, and that's where particularly some of the international financial institutions can play a significant role. In there are programs, for example, funded by the World Bank or Asian Development Bank or USAID or the UK Aid, which is the British version of USAID, and German aid agencies that are looking at diversification, but they run into this problem of the control of the agricultural system generally, where there are still these percentages of land and quotas for cotton. So it's a challenging question because it gets back to the governmental control over agriculture. Over the long term, yeah, I think if you're going to have, I mean, for the health of Uzbekistan, yes, diversification is important. Getting there, it will take some more time, I think, and significant pressure from both those who are working diplomatically, like the governments, but also those who have financial leverage, such as the banks that loan to the government, like the World Bank, Asian Development Bank.
My name is Michael Hall. I work here at Open Society Foundations. A question about about cotton, and this sort of goes into the question about some of the ways in which Western corporations are involved. you know, I don't know how it works now, if it's a similar scheme in place. The way it used to be was if someone like Cargill or Reinhardt or whoever wanted to buy cotton, they would go to one of a couple of large Western banks to put up the cash with one of these three Uzbek companies that exports cotton, right? So ABN AMRO or Credit Suisse back then. So these banks would basically put up the cash to the Uzbek government, to the Uzbek sellers. The companies would later would reimburse them. And I'm wondering if that's where they are, if they're still in the chain. We still have these Western banks in this chain anywhere as you know, underwriters basically these purchases. And if so, are they a reasonable target for advocacy?
It's a great question, and yes, that is very much the way a lot of the commodity trade works. And the banks have shied away from playing a significant role, but the last few years, particularly our coalition partners who work in Europe have engaged a lot of those, because most of the trading companies buying Uzbek cotton in the West are based in Europe. There's a lot in Asia. So most significant step in that direction was BNP Paribas did take steps to stop financing purchases of what they will publicly say is cotton from Central Asia that we can't agree with. So they put that in their last year's annual report, and the concept was exactly that, to not fund trade of Uzbek cotton. We would like that to grow from there. Like I said, most banks have been a little bit gun-shy. The other set of actors in that space are the insurers. Some of our partners in the UK at the moment are working on getting insurers to take the same step of saying, we can't insure this. This is a risk for everybody. So, yeah, it's a great point.
Okay, now I will abuse my right as moderator one last time before we close, because no one has mentioned the magical year of 2014. 2014 is the year that NATO and American forces are due to draw down from Afghanistan. Uzbekistan is a major conduit for troops, or actually materiel, going through. That relationship has prompted the United States to more or less turn a blind eye to various programs in Uzbekistan that are unsavory. After the withdrawal, does that change at all?
If I was making a prediction, I would say Uzbekistan is going to matter even less than it already matters, and it will be even harder to put any sort of pressure on anyone and bring these issues to attention. I think that's what's going to happen, because it was, you know, when I did the BBC documentary about sterilization, there was a, you know, there was an effort in Washington to bring it to attention of Hillary Clinton. She was, you know, someone went in and spoke to her about it. Avaz did a campaign about it, and so on. But, you know, absolutely nothing changed. I'm sure, you know, John Kerry will be even less motivated to have to, you know, get into the. So that's my not very optimistic
Matt,
prediction.
Yeah, Matt, final word.
I think that's fair. You know, in terms of the U.S. government, it does open up the possibility that they lean harder on the Uzbek government, because currently, in the last couple of years, you know, there's this question mark from the Defense Department, or, you know, the Pentagon, essentially. The harder you lean on Tashkent about human rights issues, the dollar per, you know, train or use of airspace keeps going up. So the price of using that network to ship things in and out of Afghanistan goes up. And so that's a very concrete worry throughout the U.S. government. And that worry in some ways goes away. I actually tend to think, though, there is a possibility that Uzbekistan will be less important, but I don't think things are going to change that much in the region. I think there will be continued sort of vying for influence in Central Asia, particularly as China, for example, seeks more natural resources in the region. I think that raised as a flag to the US and European Union and gives at least some possibility that they will continue to engage significantly. And the security aspect that, you know, the Central Asian region, including Afghanistan to a degree, is going to be somewhat unstable for a while, and Uzbekistan's another place where the next 10 years will be a time of likely change. So I tend to think governments will still have their caveats for why they don't engage as strongly as some of us human rights advocates would like them to do, but I still think they're going to be engaged in, you know, diplomatically and economically in Uzbekistan.
Thank you, and that brings this this talk to a close. I thank you all for coming, and we look forward to seeing you next time here at the Open Society Foundation.